From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. This morning, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer urged his colleagues to pass President Biden's $1.9 trillion coronavirus recovery bill before extended benefits for financially struggling people expire in just over a week.
Let's face it. We need to get this done. It would be so much better if we could in a bipartisan way, but we need to get it done.
Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us to talk about that, and also the first on-camera interview from one of the women accusing New York Governor Andrew Cuomo of sexual harassment. Let's bring in Sahil Kapoor, who is a national political reporter for NBC News. Hi, Sahil.
Great to join you.
And Domenico Montanaro is senior political editor and correspondent for NPR. Hey, Domenico.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yes. So let's start with the Senate and the coronavirus relief bill. Democrats have made some changes to trying to bring Republicans on board, like setting these limits on who will receive direct checks. And today there's this deal on extending unemployment benefits. Sahil, what's the latest here?
Let's start with today. Moderate and progressive Democrats cut a deal to reduce the federal unemployment benefits from $400 a week to $300 a week. They also, as part of this deal, decided to extend them by 1 month from August to September. And there's a key reason for that. Congress is usually out of session in August. And some Democrats were afraid of having a so-called benefit cliff in that month that lawmakers were unlikely to come back and address. This will disappoint some progressives who wanted the higher level of $400. But another key component here is that it makes the first $10,200 of jobless benefits tax-free, which is a change from previous components. The other change that they made yesterday was to the $1,400 stimulus payments. They are limiting eligibility. In other words, who can get that money? Incomes between $80,000 and $100,000 will no longer get any money. And couples who make between $160,000 and $200,000 will not get any money as they did last time.
Okay. Domenico, I want to bring you in here. Do you think these changes will get Republicans on board with this bill?
Not necessarily. I think that this shows just how tight the Senate is in general. I mean, we have a 50-50 Senate, and you know, the whole reason why Democrats are going with this approach is because they can't get past the filibuster threshold that you would need for 60 votes. But there hasn't been any indication so far that many, if any, Republicans will be on board with this. Mm-hmm. A lot of this, frankly, is to keep moderate Democrats on board, like Joe Manchin from West Virginia and Kristen Sinema from Arizona.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's what's going on in Washington. But across the country, gentlemen, this week, we also saw some Republican governors deciding to keep coronavirus restrictions and mask mandates in place while others were lifting them. And President Biden had some harsh words for those who rolled back the restrictions.
And the last thing we need is the Neanderthal thinking that in the meantime, everything's fine. Take off your mask. Forget it.
So, Sahil, how'd that go over?
Not well with Republicans, as you can imagine. There has been quite a bit of pushback. There have been conservative media outlets really focusing on that word that President Biden used and trying to create it into trying to turn it into a bigger scandal by getting people riled up about it. The White House and allies of President Biden are standing by their sharp criticism of Republican governors who are essentially lifting these restrictions even while the pandemic is still raging and still claiming lives every day. So another one of those kind of partisan culture clashes over a matter that ultimately is an issue of consensus among the scientists.
Hmm. Domenico, what's the bottom line here? I mean, will the elections in 22 and 24 be won and lost on the coronavirus?
Well, certainly this is going to be a key issue for Joe Biden and the Democrats as they move forward. I mean, this next year and how President Biden deals with coronavirus, and that means vaccine distribution and getting the economy back up and running quickly enough, being able to get loans out to small businesses, how much better people feel in a year, year and a half. As we're looking at that timetable, think about we'll be heading into the midterms. And traditionally, in the first midterm of a president's first term, the party in power does not do very well. So, this is important for Democrats to show that they are able to give help to people, that they can manage this rollout well, especially after a year of criticizing the prior administration for its chaotic handling of the coronavirus pandemic.
Okay, let's talk about another big story going on today. One of the women accusing New York Governor Andrew Cuomo of sexual harassment has given her first TV interview. Charlotte Bennett told CBS's Nora O'Donnell that Cuomo propositioned her last year while she worked with him. Let's listen.
The pandemic was obviously stressful for all of us, and he was on TV nearly every day talking about it.
You make that gown look good.
So you think all this national attention may have emboldened him?
Absolutely. I think he felt like he was untouchable in a lot of ways.
Cuomo apologized this week, saying he was sorry if he made anyone feel uncomfortable. He's now under investigation. But Sahil, pulling back a little bit, these revelations are big news because last spring, Cuomo really endeared himself in the hearts and minds of many Americans as this leader stepping up at a time when we desperately needed it. What are some of the bigger lessons here?
It's an extraordinarily sharp fall from grace for Governor Cuomo, who's now facing allegations from three women of inappropriate conduct. At least one of them has said she does not accept his apology and that his press conference when he, or rather his press statement, was filled with inaccuracies. There are already some prominent New York Democrats calling on him to resign, including Congresswoman Kathleen Rice, who represents the New York City area. So between that and the fact that Cuomo is also under fire for having allegedly rewritten the nursing home report to hide a higher death toll, that's according to the New York Times, suggests some very rough days ahead for Andrew Cuomo.
Right. I mean, is that what we're all following? Is do you think that in some way he will have to make a decision about his role as governor?
That is the biggest question that everyone is asking right now. So far, it doesn't appear that the governor is ready to heed those calls to step down. It appears that he's going to try to fight through it. But it's certainly possible that events could overcome him. And that's the question that people are remaining to see. Mm-hmm.
So that investigation into Cuomo continues. And we also have an ongoing investigation into the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. And this morning, California Democrat Eric Swalwell sued former President Trump for damages related to that event. And we've just wrapped up 2 weeks of hearings about what happened. More are on the way. Domenico, what have we learned so far?
Well, there's been a lot of pretty big pieces of this. In particular, the head of the D.C. National Guard saying didn't understand why it took 3 hours for the Pentagon to approve the request to put in National Guard troops. He said he would have done it immediately. He seemed pretty passionate about that. So I think there's still a lot of questions to be asked about the chain of command at the Pentagon. Who knew what, when, why were those things not, why did that request not get through? What did the White House know? There's still a lot there. Now, Democrats in the House have their own investigation that they were hoping would be bipartisan with General Honoré, who had gained fame in New Orleans after Katrina for his management there, but because of some of his sharp tweets about some of the senators, Hawley and Cruz, and their role in after this and before January 6th, they're trying to dismiss him and put him to the side and say, oh, he's just partisan. Well, whatever is going to come out of that is also going to play a piece of what gets determined going forward. And there's a fight going on about how seriously Republicans are taking this and whether they just want to move on from it.
Before we let both of you go, President Biden hasn't held a solo news conference yet. Most of his predecessors had by this point in their administrations. I mean, this question is for both of you. Does that matter? And I'll start with you, Domenico. Does it matter? And what questions would you pose to him?
Well, it always matters if a president of the United States is going to be transparent and answer reporters' questions. So, of course, the White House press corps and the rest of us are going to want to hear from the president about what's happening, what this rollout is going to be. We've seen and heard from him on different occasions. Of course, it'd always be great to have more time to be able to probe and see how much more deeply this goes, especially on something like school reopenings. Is it really possible when you talk to teachers and to school administrators to have 5 days a week of school full time in most places, given the size problems at school. Just the distancing makes it very difficult to do that. Did he really mean something like 2 or 3 days a week with hybrid, or does he really mean 5 and think it's totally safe?
Sahil, with the 30 seconds we have, what about you?
Well, President Biden certainly has a different strategy than his predecessor in that he's promised not to be ubiquitous the way Donald Trump was. But certainly that cannot and should not mean hiding from press conferences entirely. He will continue to face pressure to do one. And the question I'd ask him is what he plans to do about his agenda when everything gets bottled up in the Senate due to the filibuster after the COVID relief bill.
Sahil Kapoor is a national political reporter for NBC News, and Domenico Montanaro is a senior political editor and correspondent for NPR. Thank you both.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Pope Francis arrived in Iraq today and was greeted by a band and choirs at the airport. The historic trip was first envisioned by Pope John Paul II 2 decades ago. Francis is the first pope to visit Iraq.
La diversità religiosa, culturale ed etnica che ha caratterizzato la società irachena.
Speaking in Italian in his first speech, Pope Francis said religious, cultural, and ethnic diversity have been hallmarks of Iraqi society for centuries. The timing of the trip is notable. It comes amid the pandemic and Iraqi instability. NPR's Alice Fordham joins us from Erbil in northern Iraq. Alice, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much.
So we heard the music from the airport. How are Iraqis receiving the Pope?
Well, Iraqi officials are certainly very excited to show the country at its best. Cities have been spruced up, the roads have been repaved, gardens have been groomed. And I've spoken to lots of Iraqis, Christians and Muslims, who are excited about the visit because I think they'd like the outside world to focus on some of the great things about Iraq, like its ancient history. The Pope will travel to the site of Ur, for example, which according to scripture is where the patriarch Abraham was born. And for Christians, of course, this is really special. I spoke with a priest yesterday who had renovated his church so the Pope can say prayers there. It had been gutted and burned by ISIS militants. And he said a few years ago he could never have imagined such a thing.
Wow. So those are some of the things on his agenda. What has the Pope been up to today, his first of this 3-day visit to Iraq?
Well, he met officials and he gave a speech calling to celebrate Iraq's diversity and for peaceful coexistence and to seek a better world after the pandemic. And then he held a meeting with Christian leaders in a place with a huge amount of emotional resonance here, a church in Baghdad, which was devastated by an attack by terrorists a decade ago. They took over the church during a mass. And he and the clergy there spoke about that day with deep feeling and about finding hope despite this kind of violence.
Yeah, some 58 people lost their lives that day. Alice, we know this weekend the Pope is going to talk about interfaith issues. How will he do that?
Well, when he goes to Ur, he's going to hold an inter-religious event with representatives of different faiths and sects. And he's also going to go to the shrine city of Najaf to visit a top Shia Muslim cleric, the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. And to get an idea of what this means, I spoke to Haider al-Khoui, who works with his family's foundation in Najaf. And his grandfather was Sistani's teacher.
Both the Shia Islamic establishment and the Catholic Church have consistently condemned violence being committed in the name of religion. And I think that's one thing that will be a topic discussed between the Pope and Sistani.
And Haider Khoui actually told me he's met both men before. He said to me, it is striking how similar their personalities are. He said, in terms of their calmness and their piety, he thought they would see eye to eye on a personal level, not just a philosophical or a spiritual one.
Wow. So, Alice, we mentioned the pandemic. There was also that rocket attack on a U.S. base earlier this week, or a base, anyway, that U.S.-led coalition leads, I should say. How are those things affecting the Pope's visit?
Well, I think that security has been worrying lately with an uptick of attacks on military bases and the US embassy, which have been blamed on Iran-backed militias. I think the organizers are hoping that as recent targets have been mainly military, the Pope's an unlikely target. But public health experts have been very concerned. And there were a lot of unmasked choirs and dancers today. So I think their fears will remain.
That's NPR's Alice Fordham in Erbil, Iraq. Alice, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
29 years ago, we saw the dawn of a new TV genre.
This is the true story. True story.
Seven strangers picked to live in a loft
and have their lives taped.
If you're old enough to remember, that's the opening to MTV's Real World, the pioneer of reality TV. And that original cast is back.
This is the true story.
This is crazy.
True story.
Of seven former roommates.
Shut up.
To return to their original loft.
Yes. Have their lives taped again. Wow. To find out what happened.
We're back.
When people stop being polite.
Dun, dun, dun. Start getting real.
The Real World Homecoming New York debuted this week on a new streaming service called Paramount Plus. And let's go to NPR TV critic Eric Deggans to find out what happens when Eric stops being polite and starts getting real.
I am never polite, so you don't have to worry about that.
I know you're always real. That's the truth.
Exactly.
Eric, 29 years is a long time. I mean, the cast is middle-aged now. They have adult children of their own. They've established their careers. What's this reunion like?
Well, it's interesting. I think for people who were fans of the show, this reunion was, of course, just laden with all kinds of nostalgia. Mm-hmm. You know, you get to see how what we saw of them in that initial season led to them becoming the people they are now, and how that journey mirrors so much of what we all go through. Mm. And of course, one of the key elements of the show is the fact that it was the first of the sort of modern reality TV shows. You know, one of the things that we see in this reunion is that the participants are constantly talking about how they were pioneers in the genre. And we even have a clip of that. Let's check it out.
There will never be a show like ours.
We had no reference point. It was just us.
There was no reality TV.
Mm-mm.
We all thought it was a documentary on seven artists that was like more in-depth.
Exactly.
We had no idea that it was going to turn into this.
Or that there would be a reality TV show president of the United States.
That's an interesting way to put it.
Exactly.
Well, you know, the Real World kicked off reality television, as they both said. That was Kevin Powell and Rebecca Blasband. It dealt with a lot of real world issues, so to speak. I think we all remember the third season featuring Pedro, who was a gay man living with AIDS, and he really gripped and forever changed the hearts and minds of Americans. When the stigma around HIV and AIDS was really at its height back then, where does this show currently sit in the media landscape of reality TV? Is it even relevant anymore?
Well, you know, I do think it's important for people to know where this genre came from. It's not just that the show was popular. It was that the production company that made the show learned from the Real World and sort of cloned that approach across a bunch of different reality TV structures. And the other thing that was interesting, and that in a weird way I think got misused later on, was introducing conversations, heated conversations about race between black and white participants on the show. They flash back to that because Kevin Powell, again, was an activist even then. And so race became, you know, kind of a central topic. And they even flash back to some of the fights that Kevin had, particularly with Julie, one of the white women in the house. And I think we have a clip of that. Let's check that out.
At the time, my roommates, they just didn't know anything about American history. We didn't get to unpack that stuff. We need to have a conversation.
You are the biggest black or white I could ever hope to meet.
And you're a racist. Simple as that.
How am I a racist?
I mean, the way the reunion show presents it is that, you know, Kevin was right all along to confront them about these social justice issues. But what I think you really see is that the white members of the house were too resistant to engaging on this topic. And he was a little too insulting and a little too harsh about how he was trying to get them to talk about it. And he even admits that during the reunion special. And that's one of the really interesting elements. And unfortunately, I think in reality TV, we've seen producers use conflicts over race in much less educational and much more damaging ways. Mm-hmm. But it started with an effort to sort of have an actual conversation, which we saw on The Real World.
Okay, I want to ask you about another popular reality TV show franchise. We spoke a little while ago with you about the current season of The Bachelor. Host Chris Harrison has temporarily stepped down after defending a contestant who had taken racist photos. Now ABC announced that former NFL linebacker Emmanuel Acho will host the final Bachelor special. And we actually had Emmanuel on the show a little while ago to talk about his other show, Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man. What do you think? Is ABC test driving a new potential host, maybe?
I certainly hope that they're not, I'll be honest, because I think what ABC has done up until now is put Band-Aids on a situation that requires serious structural change. Mm. They're going to have a much greater diversity of people behind the scenes. They're going to have a much greater diversity of people who participate on the show. They're going to have to change up the scenarios that they present for dating, like where do these people go and what are the gender roles that they're sort of reinforcing through this contest? And none of that will change if all you do is change the person who's saying the lines to introduce the show. Mm. You know, Emmanuel's done a lot of great work on anti-racism. I hope he's able to sort of transform his little pocket of the Bachelor that they allow him to enter into. But I'm very skeptical. This feels like another attempt to just place a Band-Aid on something that is much more systemic, and it has to be about the people who control the show admitting the flaws of the show and how deep they run and changing the show in a systemic, sustained, really, really evolutionary way. And we'll see if they come up with that.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Thank you as always. Have a great weekend.
Always a pleasure.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
The news is about more than what just happened. You need to know why it happened, who made it happen, how it's felt in the communities you care about. NPR's daily news podcast, Consider This, gives you all of that, with context, backstory, and analysis on a single topic every weekday. It's not just information, it's what the news means. Consider This from NPR.
Alabama's mask mandate remains in place another month, even as the governors of Texas and Mississippi decided this week to lift theirs in a move President Biden describes as, quote, Neanderthal thinking. Republican Governor Kay Ivey said yesterday she would extend the order through April 9th, but not beyond.
Even when we lift the mask order, I will continue to wear my mask while I'm around others and strongly urge my fellow citizens to use common sense and do the same thing. But at that time, it will become a matter of personal responsibility and not a government mandate.
Andrew Yeager from WBHM joins us now with more from Birmingham. Andrew, Governor Ivey called masks one of our greatest tools in fighting the pandemic and issued what she says is going to be the last extension of a facial covering mandate. Is she threading the needle here? I mean, is this going to satisfy the pro-mask and anti-mask camps in Alabama?
Yes, there's a little bit of threading of the needle, trying to give both sides something to like in her decision. Certainly those who wanted to see this mask mandate continue were glad to have it stay enacted for another 5 weeks. I've not heard much from those, at least in state government, who wanted the mandate to end. But I would say by announcing that it will lapse on April 9th, Governor Ivey has mostly ended that will she or won't she conversation that's come up every time this order has been up for an extension.
I see. And so put this decision in context for us. I mean, what is the COVID-19 status in Alabama? And what are you hearing from doctors about the decision to set an end date for the mask order?
Yeah, doctors are pretty much focusing on vaccinations. They say that is where the pressure is. We've got to get as many shots as into as many arms as possible over the next several weeks. Here's the president of the Alabama Hospital Association, Dr. Don Williamson.
We've got to continue to maximize the number of doses of vaccine we give so that we can drive up that immunity level even more so that once the mask mandate comes off, if unfortunately people make a decision not to wear their mask, we have enough immunity in the population that we don't see a substantial increase in cases.
Now, some context on that. The state administered its 1 millionth vaccine dose this week, but that's still only about 13% of Alabamians who have received one dose. 13% of Alabamians with one dose, 7% with two doses. That's far below herd immunity.
Sure. And we are reading that officials are expecting more doses over the next few weeks before this mask mandate is lifted. But we also are seeing that the proportion of Alabama's white population getting the vaccine is almost twice that of black people in the state. So, Andrew, it still looks like there's a major equity issue there.
Yes, equity is an issue, and health officials say that they are working to address that gap. We have seen throughout this vaccine rollout that people of color have disproportionately received fewer vaccines. One of three major mass clinics in the Birmingham area is in a majority black neighborhood. Now, mass clinics may drive up numbers, but they don't always help with that issue of equity. They work well for people who are near a city, who have internet access, who can sign up for an appointment, who have access to transportation, who can afford to take time off, all those factors. But not everyone has that. So to truly reach everyone who wants a vaccine, you have to take multiple strategies.
That's Andrew Yeager, host and reporter at WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama. Andrew, thank you.
Good to be with you.
Have you been trying to find a way to connect during this pandemic, to find meaning in the day-to-day? One of my neighbors makes it a point to walk clear across Los Angeles every once in a while to clear his mind and find inspiration in his surroundings. I'm not quite there, but I really do enjoy a daily stroll along the majestic tree-lined streets of Pasadena, California. And walking the same route every day is an exercise in staying present. Pasadena is the kind of place where kids ride their bikes in the middle of the street, and the manicured lawns and shrubs rival those of the Midwest. And okay, you might think, where's the inspiration there? Well, for Octavia Butler, one of the most celebrated science fiction writers of our time, Pasadena was the spark that lit her flame.
There is something about this mix of urban and wild. She was constantly looking at these interactions of how we use, you know, wilderness and space and nature.
That's Linnell George. She's author of A Handful of Earth, A Handful of Sky, The World of Octavia E. Butler. That title comes from Butler's description when asked what it takes to write science and speculative fiction. We learn from George's book that early on in Butler's life, she used the limited world around her, only where she could get by on foot or by bus, to create new worlds and possibilities.
She was an avid walker, and she moved through her environment. And she took notes. She had little notebooks she called walk thoughts. And she would examine climate. And she examined the small changes in growth patterns from year to year, month to month, and made notations of it. That environment was a huge part of forming her imagination about sense of place in her books.
Butler died in 2006. And along with her award-winning work, she also left a blueprint of sorts, notebooks, journals, letters, to-do lists, and lots of library slips. All of this, which is now in an exhibit at the Huntington Library and Art Museum, gave author George a clearer picture of how Butler's struggles also shaped the world she would create through her stories. George was given access to all of this material, which is shown through photographs in the book.
It was like going through someone's house at first. I was almost, I have to say, and I'm a reporter, so, you know, I do lots of research, but there was something that was so intimate looking at somebody's diaries and somebody's shopping list and somebody's struggling through their trying to calculate, do I have enough money to pay my rent, pay my light bill? Do I need to pawn my bicycle? Do I have to pawn my typewriter? And in looking at things like her calendar, for example, I began to understand as a writer what it meant to shape her days as a freelance writer. And it didn't mean just sitting in the chair and writing. It meant, okay, how much time am I going to need to be on the bus? How much time do I have to go to my part-time job or my full-time job and still get my writing in? And you realize so much of her life was such a complex calculation, but she made something magnificent out of these small things.
This is what struck me most about the excerpts of Butler's journals, the contracts she made with herself, explicit notes that basically said, here are the things I need to do in order to have the space to do what I love the most. And for Butler, that was to write.
I don't think she was 13 years old by the time that she very seriously decided, you know, I am going to be a writer. And I don't exactly know what that's going to look like, but I'm going to figure it out. From an idea to, okay, what do I need? You know, I need a typewriter, I need paper, I need books, you know, I need to go to the library, I need to read more.
It's an investment in oneself, and that takes a certain amount of confidence, but you also learned, just like everyday people, I mean, there were insecurities that she felt about herself.
Absolutely. I think this was really important, I felt, for everyone to know, because most writers are pretty honest about how, what the struggle is, but to see someone, you know, like her, who, you know, everyone wants to put her on a pedestal, and she would make jokes about this, you know, it's not like I'm just pulling this, you know, my words, you know, off of a tree or out of the air. She struggled through it, and she struggled with, you know, writer's block, and she struggled with self-doubt well into adulthood. And I think the lesson that I took away is this idea of habit. You just sit in the chair and you do it, and it may look horrible and it may feel horrible, but you did something that day, and the fact that you did it means you are a writer.
The subjects Butler wrote about were often set in the future. Parable of the Sower of the Parable series, for instance, was released in 1993, and it's set in 2024 and showcases a dystopian future. A society largely collapsed by climate change, growing wealth inequality, and corporate greed. Butler was intentional in creating alternate universes where Black girls and women were at the center of forging better futures. This is part of what made her an iconic figure. She was the first science fiction writer to win the MacArthur Genius Fellowship and several Hugo Awards. With all of this in mind, author Linnell George says, being a voyeur of Butler's mundane journals and notes makes the possibility of creating a better future attainable for all of us.
Here's this woman who, she really did struggle, and was not abstract. And, you know, she didn't have advanced degrees. She didn't get to go to fancy writer's retreats. There are all these things she didn't have, but she didn't focus on what she didn't have. She focused on what she had. And if it was a diary that was rescued from a dumpster, or a book that was given to her by a friend whose cover was, you know, ripped off, or if it was some notebook that was a hand-me-down, she created huge worlds in it, and she did write herself in. And I think that for all of us who feel like, if only I could get this grant, you know, if only if I could get, you know, whatever it is you think is the missing piece of your recipe, you know, for success, she shows us that you don't need the thing that sometimes you think you need. You need to look at what you have and utilize that.
Since reading George's book, I sometimes take a notebook with me on my daily walks, and I write about what I see. The flock of parrots that pierce the sky, the cloud formations, the life cycles of the trees and the flowers in bloom. And the other people, walking just like me, trying to capture their own handful of earth and handful of sky. Enough of it to help us love, live, and create during what often feels like the darkest of times.
I've been joking to friends that, you know, Octavia has been my COVID pandemic podmate, because I've spent so much time in her words, but also following her advice. And that's exactly true. You know, she never learned to drive, you know, so she could only get as far as, say, a bus would take her or her legs. And she talked about that. But this idea, you know, once again, of like having to have something transport her somewhere to some exotic place, like, no, inspiration is absolutely everywhere. Sometimes it's sitting on a bus bench and eavesdropping. Sometimes it's making a connection as you move through a place that's familiar. Sometimes it's reading the newspaper or listening to a story on the radio, and something clicks with something else that you've been listening to. She loved the notion of serendipity, and serendipity is something that absolutely happens when you are in a place and you are looking, and it's this very focused looking, you know, being absorbed and present in the world, and you can get that and access that anywhere, but you have to have the presence of mind.
How do you get there? How do we walk Butler's path to get to that presence of mind?
I think a lot of it is slowing down. And she talked about that too, is that, you know, it's not a race. And when she was a child, she was always often in school told that she was slow and that was negative. But really, the slowness was absorbing and listening and being in her here and now. And that absorption allowed her to see. And I think it's like a meditation. And I think just stopping and looking and seeing connections, because that's what got her to her stories, was seeing connections. And that's what happens when you slow down.
That was Lynell George, author of A Handful of Earth, A Handful of Sky, The World of Octavia E. Butler. For a lot of us, reading is a way to expand our constriction and have that presence of mind. So we asked George for 5 Octavia Butler book recommendations, and you can check all of those out at hereandnow.org.
An overwhelming number of teachers in the U.S. are white, according to the most recent data from the National Center for Education Statistics. But as the nation's student population grows increasingly diverse, some experts say this imbalance is affecting learning. Sojourner Ahebe from WHYY's The Pulse reports on the long-term consequences this could have on educational outcomes for students of color.
In second grade, Noah Riley was assigned to do an immigration project. He and his classmates had to write a short paper about their ancestors' journey to the United States and make a doll that represented their family story. But Noah had a feeling his doll would look different.
My mom said that I would probably be the only one with this one, and I was the only one.
Noah wanted to tell the story of his mother's family, who is Black. Noah is a mixed-race child who attends a school in the suburbs of Philadelphia, where Black children make up only 5% of the student demographic. That's according to data from the Pennsylvania Department of Education in 2019. Noah's teacher was white.
I think it was hard for the teacher to understand why the project was an issue, that not everyone has an immigration story.
This is Noah's mother, Monet Riley.
There were obviously a large group of people that came here as slaves and not as willing immigrants.
The project forced Riley to discuss slavery with Noah, something she wasn't ready to do. Riley raised several concerns with his teacher. At the time, Black teachers made up only 1% of Noah's school district.
I think if there were more teachers of color in their school, someone could have looked at that project on the team and been able to point out the many points of inappropriateness.
Noah is in fourth grade now, and he has never had a Black teacher until this year. This absence of Black teachers is a reality for many Black students all over the country, and it's impacting their educational outcomes.
And what we wanted to look at was whether there were longer-term outcomes.
Cassandra Hart is an associate professor of education policy at UC Davis. In 2018, Hart and a team of education policy researchers explored the long-term impact of having a Black teacher as a Black student, using data from one of the most critical projects in educational research, the Tennessee Star Experiment.
So if you're matched to a Black teacher in your elementary school years, does that still matter down the line for things like your high school graduation and ultimately your college enrollment outcomes?
Hart and her team found that Black students who were exposed to Black teachers by third grade were 13% more likely to enroll in college. She says if kids had 2 Black teachers by third grade, the likelihood of college enrollment jumps to 32%.
One possibility is there may be role model benefits. So having a Black teacher, you know, in front of the class, being a subject matter expert, might sort of act as a role model and increase children's kind of long-term aspirations for themselves.
Research also shows that Black teachers tend to hold slightly higher expectations for their Black students, which Hart says also produces better, longer outcomes. The piece you're hearing is performed by Aaron Taylor. He's a Black music teacher at a middle school in Erie, Pennsylvania. Neither of his parents graduated from college, and he didn't always think that college was an option for him. But once Taylor began attending a performing arts school in Pittsburgh, he developed a close relationship with his Black trombone instructor, who gave him a key piece of career advice.
I talked to, his name is Mr. Jackson, I told him, like, I want to go to school to be a music performer. And he recommended, he was like, have you ever thought about being a teacher?
Inspired by Mr. Jackson, Taylor went to college to become a music teacher. Black teacher exposure in elementary school has the biggest impact on the most marginalized students, particularly Black boys from low-income backgrounds. That's what Constance Lindsay found. She's an assistant professor in educational leadership at UNC Chapel Hill, who worked with Hart on the same race teacher research.
Intervening with them earlier, this could be one great way to do that. That is going to be cheaper than trying to intervene on the back end when they might become disconnected from school.
At the middle school where Aaron Taylor teaches now, only 11% of the teachers are Black, though almost half of the student population is.
I think my students of color definitely depend on me in a different way. They see me as a role model. They see me as an advocate for them to succeed. They see me as someone who's made a way when there wasn't a way.
He makes sure his curriculum is reflective of the student population. Over 25 different countries are represented and 17 different languages.
So that the students who are coming from these different parts of the world, they can also provide a little bit of their own, like, authentic experience.
The experiences of his students become a tool for teaching and learning. And for Taylor, every opportunity he gets to teach his students is one more chance they get to see what's possible for themselves. For Here and Now, I'm Sojourner Ahebe.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.